Good afternoon. My name is Lisa McMurdo, and I'm from the New York State Department of Health, and I welcome you to our webinar, Zika Virus, an Update on Transplant-Associated Concerns. This webinar is sponsored by the New York State Health Department and the New York State Transplant Council. The Transplant Council is an advisory body to the Health Department. This webinar is a result of discussions with Dr. Lewis Tepperman, a Transplant Council member, who is also one of our speakers today. The department thanks him and Dr. David Conti, Chairman of the Transplant Council, for their input and leadership in organizing this event. We'd also like to thank the United Network for Organ Sharing, in particular Dr. Marion Michaels and the Disease Transmission Advisory Committee, for their invaluable guidance and collaboration in planning this webinar. We have some general housekeeping issues. Your phones are muted. You may submit typed questions via the chat window at any time during the presentations. Questions that our staff here in Albany can answer will be responded to in the chat window. The speakers will answer as many questions as they can after the presentations are given through the chat window. Your phones will be muted throughout the entire webinar. The slides will be posted in a few days to the Health Department's website, and you will be given some resources at the end which will list that website. Our objectives today are to provide current basic information concerning the epidemiology of Zika, discuss the potential for Zika to be transmitted by organ and tissue transplant, going over what we know, what we don't know, and discuss the complex Zika virus laboratory testing issues that are relevant to transplantation. We'll also discuss the various guidance that is out there on Zika to the organ, tissue, and blood community, the UNOS DTAC advice, the CDC, the American Association of Tissue Banks, and the FDA. And our overall goal is to help you synthesize the rapidly changing Zika virus information as you make decisions in your practice. Our speakers today are Dr. Lewis Tepperman, Director of Organ Transplantation, Vice Chair of Surgery at Northwell Health in Manhasset, New York, Dr. Kirsten St. George, Chief of Viral Diseases, Wadsworth Center, New York State Department of Health, Albany, New York, and Dr. Marion Michaels, Professor of Pediatrics and Surgery, the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and also co-chair of the DTAC. Dr. Tepperman and Dr. Michaels have no relevant disclosures. Dr. St. George receives research support and has collaborative research agreements with Thermo Fisher and Akani Biosystems and has a royalty-generating collaborative agreement with Zeptometrics. Dr. Michaels acknowledges her analysis reflects in part work performed on behalf of the Organ Procurement Transplant Network Ad Hoc Disease Transmission Advisory Committee. This work was supported in wholly or in part by the HRSA contract. The content is the responsibility of the authors alone and does not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the Department of HHS, nor does mention of commercial products, trade names, or organizations imply endorsement by the U.S. government. We will now move to our next speaker, Dr. Lewis Tepperman.
Thank you. If I can have the next slide. I'd like to thank the Department of Health and the New York State Transplant Council for sponsoring this, the ASTS and the AST for publicizing it, and a special thanks to Lisa McMurdo from the Department of Health for setting this up so remarkably quickly. My job as a transplant surgeon, next slide, is to frame the webinar and to touch upon issues that will be developed in greater depth by the expert panel. Zika is a flavivirus. It's the same type of arbovirus as West Nile and dengue. There is significant antigenic crosstalk with dengue and West Nile. And in fact, if an individual had dengue and you serologically tested them for Zika, you might in fact have a false positive test. Unfortunately, that antibody is not neutralizing for the Zika virus, the positive sense RNA virus. Zika proliferates in the immune system and, in fact, enters via the Fc receptor on the T lymphocyte. And as transplant professionals know, we immunosuppress our patients and specifically target that T cell that cytotoxic T cell that's going to go after a virus. West Nile was a significant event in transplantation in 2005. So briefly, if we go back and look at that flavivirus in New York City in 2005, a donor which tested positive serologically by IgG and IgM transmitted West Nile to recipients. Two of those recipients, a lung and a liver recipient, came down with an ascending paralysis, a Guillain-Barré-like illness, and died. They, in fact, came down with that and were tested by PCR RNA positive in their CSF. Now let's fast forward to the present, where there really was an excellent New England Journal article recently looking at the connection between Guillain-Barré and Zika in areas that came down significantly with the disease. So during a recent epidemic in El Salvador, during that time where there was a Zika infection, in those patients, there was an increase of 100 times the Guillain-Barré incidence. And in fact, remarkably, in Venezuela, the incidence of Guillain-Barré during a Zika outbreak was increased 877 times. Neuroinvasive disease is increased, and the estimates in 2005 for West Nile was it increased approximately 40 times normal population. In Zika, there have been estimates as high as 100 times the normal population in our transplant group for neuroinvasive disease. We, as transplant individuals, look at rewards and risks. 120,000 individuals are on the waiting list at present, and every donor is precious for us. If there was a great test that existed present that was rapid, that there was no false positives, we would be testing at-risk individuals for Zika. As we are learning, this test does not exist, but the testing is rapidly evolving. At present, travel history is going to be very important for us to consider donation, living donors and deceased donors. New York has many suburbs. Some of those suburbs include Puerto Rico and Miami, where we know there's been an increased risk and an increased prevalence of Zika. And in fact, 1% of the blood donation pool in Puerto Rico is positive for Zika, and there have been 600 cases recently reported in Florida. Unfortunately, a Zika infection in 80% of the individuals is asymptomatic. So right now, we're going to be listening to our experts on the testing, the epidemiology of disease, and recommendations. I'd now like to introduce Kirsten St. George. She's the head of the Laboratory of Viral Diseases at Wadsworth, and she's going to be speaking about Zika virus testing for tissue and organ donors.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tepperman, and thank you to the organizers and sponsors for the invitation to speak this morning. I'm going to be talking relatively briefly about the virus and the clinical and epidemiological aspects of Zika virus disease, and then moving on mostly on the laboratory testing aspects and commenting on as they pertain to tissue and organ donors, or at least what we know at this stage, although there is really a great deal yet to be learned and that we don't know. So, as we know, Zika virus is a member of the flaviviridae family in the genus flavivirus, and as all members of that genus, it's a single-stranded RNA virus. It was first recognized in 1947 when it was detected in monkeys in a forest in Uganda, and after 1952, it was seen in sporadic cases and very small outbreaks, relatively small outbreaks around Africa and Southeast Asia and in some of the Pacific Islands. And we were actually watching some of these small outbreaks with sort of vague interest in my own laboratory here in New York, and actually had some tests in development because we were just a little concerned at the potential for confusion with dengue, and there were certain reasons for that. But it was not a major concern. In 2007, there was an outbreak on Yap Island, which was considerably bigger, and that's the geographic location is shown in the map there on the right. It's just north of Papua New Guinea. But then, of course, major concerns following the outbreak that started in Brazil in May 2015 and has erupted into a very sizable outbreak across Central and South America. And the clinical features compared to dengue and chikungunya, two of the other significant arboviral diseases that spread in the same areas as Zika, fever, rash, conjunctivitis, arthralgia, and so on. Fever is not always present with Zika. It tends to be very common with dengue and chikungunya, but it is usually present with Zika infections when they are symptomatic. Almost invariably, there's rash in symptomatic cases and commonly conjunctivitis. What's not present usually is hemorrhagic fever and shock, which are almost only ever seen in the more severe cases of dengue. In general, the clinical course for most people is mild, lasting just a few days to a week, but notably, approximately 80% of infections are actually asymptomatic. And this is quite different to dengue or chikungunya, where we're quite sort of the opposite. The majority of infections are actually symptomatic. And severe disease requiring hospitalization is really relatively uncommon with Zika, with the exception of co-infections with other arboviral diseases. And these are not rare. In areas where the arboviral diseases are co-circulating, co-infections are actually quite common. So when there are co-infections with Zika, these can become quite severe, and those patients sometimes require hospitalization. But Zika on its own rarely causes disease that's severe, and fatalities are quite rare. Where the real issues have arisen and the major concerns arise are with maternal-fetal transmission and the threat to the developing fetus. And we, as we all know, this has been associated with some very serious adverse effects, the first of which was the noted rise in incidence of microcephaly, but since then many other adverse neurological damage and so on. Also, the quite significant rise in incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is also of quite concern. So those two areas are really the major clinical concerns with otherwise healthy patients. When we look at the modes of transmission, mosquito bites are still the major route, and the main mosquito-borne vector is the Aedes aegypti mosquito. This is the most efficient vector for Zika virus. It's also the mosquito that spreads yellow fever. Aedes albopictus is a theoretical vector. It has been associated in one country with the spread of Zika, but fortunately it's not an efficient vector for the virus. At this point, there is concern that it could become a vector if the virus mutated. That is what happened with chikungunya. That mosquito is also the vector for dengue and chikungunya. It lives in and around households. It's an aggressive and primarily daytime biter, although it can also bite at night. Other modes of transmission, of course, the maternal-fetal route, most concerning the intrauterine, but there can also be perinatal transmission. And of course, as we know, there's quite many reports now and many cases of sexual transmission, although they are nowhere near as many as the cases of mosquito-borne transmission. Blood transfusion has been reported for a long time, including long before this Central and South American outbreak. The potential for organ and tissue transplantation, and breast milk remains a somewhat controversial area. There's certainly live Zika virus being detected in breast milk by culturing the virus out of breast milk. There's also a theoretical risk of transmission of dengue and some of the other arboviruses through breast milk, although not necessarily proven. But the WHO certainly still advocates breastfeeding in nursing mothers in these areas. We certainly do not advocate that there is any suggestion of not breastfeeding in these areas, but there would just be an exercise of caution if there was a positive mother, obviously. These maps show the general geographic distribution of those two mosquito types in the United States. On the left, Aedes aegypti, the mosquito of greatest concern. As we can see, it's mostly in the south and the southeast especially. not spreading, fortunately, at this stage up to New York. And on the right, Aedes albopictus, which at this stage, as I said, is not really very efficient at spreading Zika. In fact, it's not a vector for Zika at this point, only one reported country that ever had that as an agent for it. But it does spread up into New York. This gives a more detailed indication of the geographic distribution in New York State. In the darker purple counties with albopictus, and in the lighter purple counties where additional trapping is taking place to determine how much further northward it is spreading. So we are at the New York State Department of Health, the people involved in arboviral disease surveillance are certainly watching both the virus and the mosquito vector very carefully. This is a very recent map of the distribution of cases throughout the United States from the MMWR just earlier this week. Number of confirmed and probable cases reported throughout the US from January through to the end of July of this year. It is already by now out of date because there have been many hundreds of cases since this data was generated, but we can see that there's a predominance of cases in California, Texas, Florida, and up here in New York, at least amongst the reported detected cases. And we know that the surveillance systems in the US are really very good, so that that case count is probably really very accurate compared to case counts in some other countries. And this is a month-by-month total case count from that same MMWR, confirmed and probable cases from the US across January through July. And as we can see, when we get to July, we start to see the locally acquired cases. There in July 28, that number is now unfortunately higher. I apologize for the numbers on this slide being so tiny and a little bit difficult to read, but this is just to show you the more recent data. This is to demonstrate the last two slides that were only up until July from that MMWR that only just came out, but this is data up to September. From ArboNet, this is the National Surveillance Network for arboviral diseases. This data comes up to September 14th. And if we look down to Florida, Florida alone now reporting 596 cases. So this is to just give an indication of how high the cases have climbed even since the end of July, and they are continuing to climb really very rapidly. If we look at what viruses in the laboratory we can look to detect at what times, before, during, after the marker points of infection. And we note at point zero there is first symptoms, but as I said before, this is a really difficult disease in some ways, with 80% of cases asymptomatic. Where is your marker? So when we're testing in a laboratory, we're very commonly looking not at what was the date of onset of symptoms, but what was the last date of travel, or what was the date of travel into an area where there is active Zika transmission. And that alone can be difficult if the dates of travel were prolonged. If somebody was in a Zika virus area for a few days, then that's not so difficult. But if somebody was on a vacation or business trip into one of these areas for a month, then to try and pin down the time of transmission and the time of infection and so on to put it into this kind of context and figure out what would be the best test to run when to determine whether or not they were infected can start to become very difficult. But in general, the incubation period, starting on the left-hand side of that graph, the incubation period can run anywhere from a few days up to 2 weeks. And then after the first symptoms in the patients that become symptomatic, you will start to see viral RNA in the peripheral blood. Now, that is not an 100% accurate graph, because we actually do know that you can get viral RNA in the blood before the development of symptoms. That's been well proven for quite a long time, at least in some cases, not always. And so actually even before the development of symptoms, patients can be viremic. But certainly for those first few days after the development of symptoms, you should be able to detect RNA in the blood with molecular detection systems. When it becomes negative is very dependent on the sample that you're testing, the volume of the sample that you're able to get through the test system, and the the blood compartment that you're measuring. There's been a predominance of measuring serum and plasma. We're now looking at whole blood. It looks as if it actually might be a better a component to use rather than serum and plasma, but that's ongoing. I'll get to that in a little bit later. And then, of course, there's serological diagnosis. IgM starts to come up, but it's IgM notably is not present in those very first few days after the development of symptoms. So if an IgM test is used very early on, it's likely to be negative. And there can be a short gap between the disappearance of virus RNA if you're using a test that happens to be not at the most sensitive end of the spectrum. There can be a gap where the viral RNA is negative and the IgM is not quite yet positive, and you might be unlikely enough to have someone that appears to be negative. So in those cases, we recommend repeat testing to make sure we haven't missed someone who's actually infected. So it can be, while it looks straightforward, it actually diagnosing Zika can be quite complex, and we always need to know date of onset or date of travel for that reason, so that we can be absolutely sure that we're judging the application of the testing systems correctly. As I mentioned, the different types of assays being applied against that timeline. First of all, the molecular assays, commonly referred to as PCR assays, and the most commonly applied chemistry is actually what's known as real-time RT-PCR, and this is a real-time chemistry system using reverse transcription PCR, and reverse transcription PCR because it's an RNA virus, and this detects the viral RNA in whatever sample it is that you're testing. We use serology to detect IgM, and that should be collected more than 3 or 4 days after the illness onset, because in those very early days, it's too early for the IgM to be detectable. And then because the IgM assays are not specific, as Dr. Tefferman mentioned, there's a lot of cross-reactivity. I'll get to the details on that in a minute. We need to go to some more specific serology tests in the event of a positive detection on the IgM test. And for that, the nationally accepted deal breaker is known as the plaque reduction neutralization test, which detects Zika virus-specific neutralizing antibodies and distinguishes them from other cross-reacting antibodies that have been raised against dengue virus and others. And I will get to specifics on those in a moment. So this is a table that just lists the actual diagnostic assays that are used here at the New York State Department of Health, the molecular assays and the various serological assays. You'll see one in there on the left-hand side, the total antibody assay, the microsphere immunofluorescence assay, the MIA, which actually measures, as it suggests, total antibodies to flaviviruses. And I'm not going to talk in great detail about that one, but we do use it as a catch-all for patients who may have a IgM response that has waned, and we need to see if they had generated one. They would have lost their PCR positivity. The IgM may have waned, and we still need to see if they were at some stage positive. We use that assay, but I don't want to talk at great length of that. It's an assay that's only used within New York State, and it gets into some complexities of diagnostics. This slide is a really FYI slide for you to have at this stage, and it keeps being added to on a at least weekly basis. It's a list of the Zika virus molecular assays that have had emergency use authorization from the FDA. This is a national requirement. None of us are using any kind of assays for Zika diagnosis that have not had their validation data reviewed by the FDA and the FDA given emergency use authorization. Now, what emergency use authorization means compared to general FDA approval is that they have reviewed a less stringent amount of validation data than they would normally require to approve an assay because they have been doing this in response to a public health emergency. In the absence of a public health emergency, they will not issue EUA, and you are required to submit full validation data. But in the event of a public health emergency, they will acknowledge that there is elevated need for a rapid approval process, and they have a separate system to accept a lesser amount of validation data and issue what's known as emergency use authorization on diagnostic tests. And that's what's happened with these tests. The important point is that as soon as the public health emergency ends, the authorization on these on every one of these tests expires, and they become ineligible for use as diagnostic devices. And any company or manufacturer that's making them, if they want to still continue to use them for diagnostic purposes, has to resubmit to the FDA for full approval. So the use of them is only allowable while the public health emergency continues. We need to look at other sample types frequently, in addition to serum or plasma or even whole blood, when we're looking at diagnosing Zika virus in patients, because it was found fairly early on that there is virus detectable in other compartments and other body fluids that remains positive for longer. The serology for Zika virus is complicated and can be difficult to interpret, and the easiest way to diagnose a positive case is by PCR. However, because it becomes negative so quickly, in blood, everybody started hunting around for a sample type that stayed positive longer. And this figure from a paper by Gurinath in 2015 demonstrated that urine, at least in these six patients, remained positive for much, much longer. And a number of the state public health labs, New York State included, started testing for urine straight away, and we found same thing, that in the majority of cases, urine was staying positive for considerably longer than serum, and so we test in urine as well. This is a graph from a paper we have in preparation at the moment that demonstrates also that the viral loads in urine are also significantly higher than they are in serum, and that makes it easier to detect, as well as the fact that it stays positive longer. Interestingly, in semen, it stays positive even longer. This is from a paper just published in Lancet. This patient remained, this was a 32-year-old male, just returned from French Guiana. This man had no other underlying predisposing conditions that would cause him to remain positive for prolonged periods of time. He was HIV negative, no immunocompromising conditions or anything like that. And you can see the plasma and the urine went negative by 46 days, a relatively long period of time really for plasma, but the urine, the semen positivity is still positive right out at 139 days. And with regard to Zika in potential tissue and organ transplant donors, it's this kind of data that really gives us pause, because this tells us that at least in some infected individuals, there is virus still in the body in some places and for very prolonged periods of time. The fact that we are seeing negative serum, negative urine, negative even whole blood, which is we now believe a stronger indicator than either serum or urine, does not prove that the virus has been cleared from the body. And where else besides semen it may be at this stage, we don't know. There is evidence in animal models that it is present in eyes, in tears, and so on, but that work has been done in animal models. How well it correlates to infections in humans at this stage, we don't know. But this kind of data really is giving us pause. We do not know the full tissue distribution or how prolonged its presence in organs is by measuring virus in blood or measuring virus in blood and urine. So I think we have to be very cautious about how much comfort that gives us when we have negative test results. When we look at the different sample types that we're using for diagnostic testing, obviously serum, plasma, now whole blood increasingly being investigated as a potential improvement there. Urine, saliva was looked at briefly. It was not found to have any additional benefit over urine. Semen, I mentioned. CSF, when there's neurological involvement, and of course among infected pregnant women, amniotic fluid, and also in the event of infected fetal tissues and placenta and sometimes umbilical cord and so on for assessing transmission to the fetus. I realize that this is not necessarily relevant to the transplant question. I just have this in here for completeness. So looking back again at the timing of viremia and antibody development, this graph shows a little better the pre-symptomatic viremia with RNA in the blood before even the development of symptoms, and hopefully overlapping the development of IgM antibodies, but unfortunately not always, depending on the sensitivity of the test that you're using to detect it. As I mentioned, it's detectable more than 4 days after onset, but previous infection or vaccination with other related flaviviruses can result in false positive results. If the result is negative, it certainly suggests that there's no infection unless the specimen's been collected too early, or if it's been collected so late, so far after the exposure that the IgM may have waned. But if it's positive, the result needs to be confirmed with a plaque reduction neutralization test. And this figure on the right shows the big branching phylogenetic tree of flaviviruses. And over in the top right, in the red box, is Zika. And it shows you how close, right next to it, I don't know if on your screen you'll be able to see it, but right next to it, just to the left, are all the dengue viruses. So phylogenetically, they are extremely closely related. In some of the other branches, you'll see yellow fever and West Nile and St. Louis encephalitis, Japanese encephalitis, Powassan, and so on, that have the potential to antigenically cross-react in the serological assays we use for Zika. So that can really wreak havoc in trying to get an accurate diagnosis when you are using some of the antigens that have this cross-reactivity. There are only two serological assays at this stage that have FDA emergency use authorization, and they are listed there. First of all was the CDC's Zika IgM capture ELISA, the so-called Zika MAC ELISA, more recently the InBias. So the MAC ELISA has been used in most of the state public health laboratories, and it is an extremely time-consuming, labor-intensive assay. It takes 2 days to perform and minimum number of samples per plate, and it is very, very difficult to get these assays pushed through in high volume sample numbers. So this has created some huge backlogs for some of the state laboratories trying to push it through, and it became almost impossible to put it into a high throughput situation in the larger laboratories. We're looking forward to some additional commercial assays and some more automation in this area. And the CDC had to issue a disclaimer that it had low specificity, and even the plaque reduction assay was unable to resolve a proportion of the positive specimens, and that they were limiting testing to qualified laboratories designated by the CDC. In practice, there are only a handful of labs around the country, I think three, who are qualified to perform the PRNT assay on samples that are IgM positive. And so this creates a serious issue for getting clarification on IgM positive patients. So what is this plaque reduction neutralization test? As I said, it's a more specific diagnostic assay. It actually measures neutralizing antibody in the serum. It's a biological assay based on inactivation of the virus in a culture-based system, and it can discriminate between cross-reactive antibodies, although it can still be difficult to distinguish infecting virus in people who've had prior exposure to some of those other flaviviruses, and it commonly needs a convalescent specimen to really distinguish. You have to dilute the serum and do challenge neutralizations against a set plaque count of virus, and then incubate overnight, and then infect cell monolayers, and then incubate, wait for plaques to develop, and stain and count plaques, and then calculate the neutralizing antibody titer. This is not for the faint-hearted. This is not for laboratories who are inexperienced with virus culture systems. There are a decreasing number of labs who are experienced with cell culture systems, and there are very few labs who are experienced with performing this kind of neutralization test. And that because of that, there are extremely few labs who are approved by the CDC to perform this one for Zika. This is what the test actually looks like. If you look across the bottom on the left-hand side, that is a whorl with a huge number of plaques. that is where there is no neutralization. In the top right, you have a monolayer with very few plaques. There's a high level of neutralization there from the serum that's been put in those wells. So where you have, say, 100 plaques, that indicates no plaque reduction, that indicates there's no virus antibody present, and where there's 90% or greater reduction of the virus plaques, that is where the virus neutralizing antibody titer is designated to be. So it is a complex assay and not one that is in the least way applicable to a donor situation, because it takes 2 weeks to perform, so certainly not where you have a donor waiting on life support. This would be completely inapplicable. And there is interim guidance from the CDC in the NNWR on June on how to interpret all this combination of tests, and this chart makes it look clear-cut and definitive, but myself and all of my colleagues in epidemiology here at the State Department of Health would happily tell you, I'm sure, that every second test that we get is more difficult than that chart would suggest when it comes to interpreting serology results. It really is very difficult. So what are the issues, the challenges, and the unknowns? This is not a complete list, but just some of the things that we are still faced with. Deciding on test method, molecular versus serology, and the molecular is much more straightforward. If it's positive, it's positive. With serology, if it's positive, it has to be teased apart and interpreted very carefully. Which sample type should we use? That's still in question. The viral loads are problematic. They are usually very low, which makes detection difficult, and you have to go to very high sensitivity tests. The viremic periods tend to be very brief, except in instances such as some of the prolonged viremias that we've seen in pregnant women. There is extensive antigenic cross-reactivity. There is very little data on the tissue or organ distribution of the virus in humans. Test availability has been problematic. There are increasing numbers of clinical and commercial laboratories coming on board with testing, but this has been slow. There are issues we have to be careful of with FDA EUA approval, and I think it should be noted there are a couple of tests, molecular tests, that are currently undergoing investigational trials for blood donor testing, and this is a very different regulatory pathway to EUA for diagnostic devices. The trials are very different, and the review process and the approval process at the FDA is very different for approving the use of a device as a donor test to approving and using a device as a diagnostic. These are two very, even if it's the same test, they are two very different trials, approval processes, and approval categories. And there are also biosafety concerns, of course, even for people working with the virus, if you have staff members who are pregnant. I mentioned commercial labs coming on board, but there's a limited number of tests that they're able to use. And just a note that from our own New York State data, notably from September 19th, we had 788 total cases, but if you look toward the bottom, the vast majority have actually been diagnosed based on PCR. Only 37 were actually able to be resolved from PRNT alone, and I think that's very telling of how difficult the serology has been with Zika. So what are the laboratory testing options for molecular assays? As I mentioned, there are currently two assays in trial. We can confirm the presence of infection, but the failure to detect does not exclude the possibility that virus is present, and infectious virus may persist in organs long after the resolution of viremia. And the serology involves IgM capture, ELISAs, plaque reduction, and there are numerous practical issues regarding rapid access and result availability for deceased donors. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. I'm Marian Michaels, and we'll take it from here. Dr. Tepperman has rightly set the stage, and we've certainly heard the intricacies about testing as well as the epidemiology from Dr. St. George. So with that, let's turn to Zika virus and organ transplantation. If I could have the next slide, please. So I think the first important thing to recognize is there are a lot of questions that are as yet unanswered. In particular, what are the actual consequences of Zika virus in transplantation recipients or in other immunosuppressed hosts? We don't as of yet know how long the infectious Zika virus will persist in different organs, and accordingly, as Dr. St. George really pointed out, will testing of the urine or the blood be the appropriate spot, and will it tell us if the virus is still in the kidney, the liver, or the heart? Equally important is going to be whether the testing we have available is practical or for potential organ donors due to the time frame that it takes to get a result back, and also false positives and false negatives. And finally, are there recommendations that can be made in the interim to help us with dealing with these issues in transplantation? Now, next slide, please. To highlight for those who may not be familiar with my group, the Ad Hoc Disease Transmission Advisory Committee, or DTAC, is part of OPTN, the Organ Procurement Transplant Network Patient Safety Program, which falls under the U.S. Health and Human Services. And members are charged to examine unexpected potential donor-derived transmission events, and mainly this consists of infection or malignancies. We then categorize them as to whether or not they're donor-derived, and we evaluate aggregate data to enhance patient safety. It allows for informing of public policy and improving existing processes, as well as educating the transplant community. And just to highlight the number of potential donor-derived transmission events that come up, next slide. You can see that when we first started, there were very few cases for us to evaluate, but in recent years, it's close to 300 potential donor-derived transmission events that we evaluate. So now let's go back to Zika virus and transplantation and what we know so far. Next slide, please. And we'll go back to slide number 5, if you can get back there. So thus far, organ donor-derived transmission has not actually been reported. And just to highlight, in 2015-16, when Zika virus was in the Americas, we looked at 480 cases that have been submitted to DTAC, and none of these have been Zika virus. Now, that doesn't mean there hasn't been any, but as of yet, we haven't seen a signal that's come to our attention. When we go to the literature to look at other immunosuppressed hosts, there are, in fact, 3 HIV-positive people who were in the literature with Zika virus, albeit without significant disease. Now, we do know, as Dr. Tepperman has brought up, that other flaviviruses have clearly been transmitted with donor organs, namely West Nile virus, which was well recognized to be donor transmitted with much more severe consequences in the transplant recipient compared to West Nile virus in a healthy host. In addition, there have been anecdotal case reports of dengue transmission in endemic countries. Next slide. There is clearly a potential for infection. As we know, Zika virus is found in the blood, bodily fluids, as well as tissues. In 2013, when the French Polynesia outbreak occurred, 42 of the 1,500, or about 3% of blood donors, tested positive. And more recently, in 2016, it was reported that 1% of asymptomatic blood donors in Puerto Rico tested positive. Brazil has also put into the literature several transfusion-associated cases of Zika virus. And with the next slide, I'd like to just highlight one of those cases because it involved an organ transplant recipient. In this case, a donor of blood who was asymptomatic at the time of blood donation, which was noted on days minus 2, developed a febrile illness 2 days later and critically, I'd say, called the donor center and reported his febrile illness. When they went to quarantine his blood, they discovered that platelets from him had been used in a recipient undergoing liver transplantation. Initially, because of the epidemiology, they thought it might be dengue, and dengue testing both on the donor blood and on the recipient were negative. But the RT-PCR for Zika virus on stored blood from the blood donor was positive. On the far right-hand side in purple, when the recipient was evaluated, hemagglutinin inhibition antibody was positive for flavivirus. The RT-PCR for Zika virus was positive, and likewise, they were able to actually have virus isolation on cell culture. The recipient was asymptomatic in this report, and on day 18 follow-up, antibody was still positive for flavivirus, but the PCR was negative. Next slide. There was 99.8% homology in the sequence sections of blood donor and recipient virus, and accordingly, platelet transfusion was highly suspected as the culprit. Now, while anecdotal, basically we have a sample size of one, it is reassuring that this liver recipient was asymptomatic despite having infection on day of transplant with intense immune suppression. Likewise, to me, it was really quite telling that he was able to clear viremia on the day 18 sample. I also want to highlight that we really, the recognition of this case would not have come to our attention had the donor not reported his symptoms 2 days after donation. And I think that's something that we all have to remember, that it has to be stressed that donors do come back and tell us if there's a problem. Next slide. The FDA guidance for industry in February 2016 put out recommendations for blood donors. It was recommended to defer donation for 4 weeks after resolution of symptoms if one was diagnosed with Zika virus or if they traveled to an area with Zika virus transmission, or after last sexual contact with a man with Zika virus exposure or Zika virus in the past 3 months, based on the data that Dr. St. George showed on it being present in the semen. August 17, 2016, on the next slide, is shown the revised recommendations for reviewing for reducing the risk of Zika virus transmission by blood and blood products. The recommendations that were put out showed that blood banks with locally acquired mosquito-borne cases of Zika virus should be testing now, and that was Florida and Puerto Rico. They also noted that neighboring states or those with other epidemiologic links to Zika virus should implement testing within 4 weeks, which, since it was in August that it was put forward, actually is now. And I just want to highlight that New York is included in that group. All other states and territories were to implement as soon as feasible, but not later than 12 weeks. And as Dr. St. George pointed out, they did specify that it was okay to use the investigational ID maps under IND or FDA-approved pathogen reduction techniques. Next slide. For those blood donors who test positive, it was important to have them informed and counseled, and likewise that they should defer further donation now instead of the 4 weeks for 120 days from the time of a positive test, or for those few who develop symptoms for 120 days after symptom resolution, whichever is longer. If it is found out that blood components were used, the recipient's physician is supposed to be notified so that they can offer counseling to the recipient and as well monitor them for disease. The FDA also provides guidance for human cells, tissues, and cellular and tissue-based products on the next slide. And for living donors, they're ineligible if in the past 6 months they had a Zika virus diagnosis, they traveled to an area with active Zika virus, or they had sex in the past 6 months with a male partner who had either travel or a Zika virus diagnosis. For non-heartbeating cadaver donors, they're ineligible if a medical diagnosis was made in the past 6 months. Now let's turn to organ transplantation on this slide. In February of 2016, members from DTAC, the American Society of Transplantation, and the American Society of Transplant Surgeons reviewed the available data, as well as FDA and CDC guidance, and put out comments for the organ transplant community. Now, I want to note that we are, in fact, updating these comments that were put forward in February. Unfortunately, they're still in review, and while they will be coming out very shortly, they are not fast enough for today's webinar. As you can see, at the time when this came out, there really was not a lot to be able to be said for living donors of organs, other than in the case of a potential living donor with Zika virus, donation should be deferred when possible. I want to highlight that in the upcoming recommendations, we've basically added the timeline that with the available data, the deferral will probably be 6 months. But I want to caution that we are continuing to say when possible. And as you will note, with organ transplantation, it's always a balancing act of potential risk and potential benefit. Now, on the next slide is the guidance for deceased donor. And again, we really emphasize the importance of focusing on recent travel history and epidemiologic risk factors, as well as recent donor symptoms, recognizing the fact that that there are very few people that will actually have symptoms, as only 20% will be symptomatic. Again, as highlighted in the slide, while there is a potential for Zika virus infection, the DTAC, AST, and ASTS do not believe that the concern for Zika virus infection should summarily exclude donors for transplantation. Rather, the risk of donor-derived infection should be balanced with the potential benefit. Also, one has to remember that other viruses can be transmitted, such as dengue and chikungunya. Next slide. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, I think we have to really learn from experience, and very grateful to LifeLink OPO of Puerto Rico for sharing their recent data where Zika virus has clearly been active. Thus far, through August of 2016, 61 organ donors have given 191 organs to be transplanted. 88 were used locally, and 103 were exported. And on the next slide, we can show that in February of 2016, LifeLink of Puerto Rico started reporting on all of the organs that they were in a Zika endemic area, and likewise, LifeLink Florida and LifeLink Georgia noted if the donor had traveled. If you go to the next slide, you see that quite quickly in March, they had an addendum where they specifically asked the family if the named person had been medically diagnosed with Zika in the past 6 months. And on the next slide, we can see that most recently, in September 6th, they added further questionnaire to the medical history of the donor, looking for disease symptoms such as joint pain, conjunctivitis, or whether they had traveled to a Zika virus area. Next slide, please. So I want to, in the last few minutes, end with strategies for prevention. So it's really quite important for safe living before and after transplantation. And on the next slide, you can see that I really highlight that we need to be much more proactive as transplant physicians, nurses, and healthcare workers in giving advice to our candidates and our recipients. For those who are living in a Zika virus active transmission area, it is critical that we tell them to use protective measures to avoid mosquito bites, and likewise either have complete avoidance of sex or to use condoms when having sex with males. For those not living in an area with active Zika virus transmission, travel precautions must be discussed, the risk-benefit of even traveling. Now, if traveling occurs, again, all of the measures for avoidance of a Zika need to be discussed, avoidance of sex or correct condom use with sex with males, and the standard mosquito avoidance measures. And I just want to highlight that it should be continued for 3 weeks when they return from travel, really in case they are viremic, to prevent a new mosquito that's in the local geographic area picking up the virus and transmitting it to others. Next slide. For the living donors, it becomes a little bit more of a question because we don't really know what the appropriate period for deferral if diagnosed with Zika virus or having symptoms suggestive of Zika virus is. And also about counseling the potential donors regarding travel, sexual contacts, and what about for those people living in areas with Zika virus? Right now, those recommendations haven't been put forward and I think are direly needed. Next slide. So where are we and where do we go from here? I think it's critical that we recognize the potential for transmission of Zika virus, maintain a very low threshold for evaluating our recipients that have suggestive symptoms, report any suspected Zika virus transmission due to transplantation, continue to encourage living donors to report post-donation symptoms and learn from those centers and sites where Zika virus is currently active. Now, on the next slide, as Dr. Kirsten St. George pointed out, we really have a lot of challenges. It's a rapidly changing epidemiology. It is clearly a problem with pregnancy, but still an unknown at the extent of a problem for transplantation. And better understanding is needed for disease in the transplant recipient and risk of organ donation specifically. The lab logistics and challenges are not to be underestimated, and we haven't even discussed treatment strategies. In the final couple slides, I just want to highlight, we really are basing all these problems on the fact that there is such an incredible discrepancy between the number of patients awaiting transplant in orange and the number of available organs in blue. Next slide. Every 10 minutes, someone is added to the national transplant waiting list, and on average, 22 people die every day waiting for a transplant. And next slide. And it is accordingly this intense donor shortage that has to be put into the risk-benefit analysis. Unlike blood donation with a renewable supply, we have insufficient organ donors, and we always have to keep in mind that there can be a disconnect between the reality and perception of risk. With organ donation, there is always some risk. We never get to a zero, and we just have to keep that in mind. And with the very final slide that I put in from a colleague of mine, who's a transplant infectious disease physician at Sharif, I think it keeps us in mind to say we've considered every potential risk except the risk of avoiding all risk. We have some resources available to you on the next slide, and we're happy to entertain questions if there's any time left. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Michaels. I really want to thank all of our speakers today. I really think we have learned a little bit more about what the issues are with Zika and what it may mean for us in the future with transplant. We only have a couple of minutes left. We're actually over, but I did want to see if either any of the speakers have been looking at any of the questions. We only had a few questions come in. Some people did ask about the getting access to the slides, and the slides will be posted on the Health Department website. If we go to the resource slide, the resource slide will have the Health Department's website, and you need to go to the Zika page. If you click on the mosquito, that will lead you to the page for info for providers. And then also you saw my email was there as well, and if you want to communicate directly with me, you may. I don't know if Dr. Michaels or Dr. Tepperman were looking at any of the questions and had any comments they wanted to make in the minute or two we have left. Or Dr. St. George noticed one of the questions. Give us a sec. She's reading this. Dr. Tepperman and Dr. Michaels, do you have any other comments?
I can't actually see the question. So if there's one specific for me, if someone could read it out.
I think they were answered pretty well. There was a question for one individual said, are there any specific recommendations for sperm or egg donors?
So they're covered under the FDA regulations for tissue and cellular human products. So there are actually FDA regulations for that. And that's the six-month window for deferral if there's been a diagnosis, and will be on the slides. I can't remember which number slide it was. But that is also easily accessible under FDA recommendations for human cells and tissue products.
There's a question that came in on how long the IgM is positive, or how long it's detectable, and this is quite variable. We tend to say 12 weeks on average, but it really is very variable depending on the person's antibody responsiveness, the robustness of their immune system in general, but also if they have other flavivirus antibody immune responses, that will temper the response to Zika virus and tend to make it a little shorter. So we certainly can't guarantee that it will stay positive for 12 weeks. It can be considerably shorter. If there is a real likelihood of exposure and the IgM is negative, then you really have no choice but to go to PRNT.
So I think we will end the webinar now. I just want to go to the last slide again with the questions, just so you can see my email address if you want to directly ask me any questions. We really have covered all of the questions, and we do thank all of the speakers for their time and all of you for listening and attending today. Thank you.
Thank you once again.
Thank you.
This concludes this conference call. You may now disconnect.